You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, thanks. I'll do the same with you. I have to say, there was, you know, once in a while, my wife will let me go out to see movies by myself, and I indulge in boy movies. And you know where I'm going with this, right?
Yes, sir, I do.
I mean, I just saw the preview for Warrior, and I thought, this looks like something I'm going to like. And
that's great.
Man, I loved it.
It was a good movie, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm coming out another movie. I'm going to the premiere tonight, in fact, called Ride Along, which is this big shoot 'em up comedy thing, and I play sort of a crooked cop, and so we'll see what happens. It's very much a boy movie, so if you get a chance, go out there and take a look.
Good. Ride Along, okay.
Yeah, almost went to Loomis Chaffee. I went to Northfield Mount Hermon instead.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
It's so interesting. Yeah, oh, yeah. We used to play with you all the time.
Yep, yep.
I should play with you may not be right.
Well, you know, I understand what you mean.
Listen, play it's boarding with. School. It's boarding
right.
school.
I was a wrestler, so in some ways, I mean, you know, we rolled around on a mat together. What are you going to do?
It's the finest classical education, right? You know,
exactly.
That's it. That's classic stuff. Yeah, well, our coach, I played a little basketball, and our coach would say, let's go out there and play our boy-to-man defense.
I love it. I like the way this podcast. Are we recording, by the way? See that? We just jump into it. We're talking to Steven Zrogatz, who's a professor at Cornell University in mathematics. Though you got your PhD in applied mathematics from Harvard University, which I would just wear as a tattoo,
probably on your forehead, right?
Yeah. And I love this because you got it, you got your research in the dynamics of the human sleep-wake cycle. And we just had Dr.
Professor Russell Foster.
Yeah, from Oxford University, who's a sleep expert.
Okay.
So you're fitting in well. Your book, The Joy of X, and I should mention you also have a course I've not taken yet, but I'm a huge fan of the great courses. And you have a course that you teach, I think, on chaos theory.
That's right.
Right. And so, you know, one of the things that I have to say in reading your book is you see the world in a very different way. And I found myself so sort of envious and realizing that in many ways, and it's funny in life, you realize you're very blind to a lot of what goes on in the world. It's one of the frustrating things about being a human being is you can't know everything. But I was so fascinated with how numbers and the way you described as how numbers really do play out in our everyday life. For example, 2 negatives make a positive. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. You know, that's something I never had thought about. But what I want to do with this podcast, Stephen, is our professor. Let's just call you professor. It just sounds you've earned
Don't
it.
Don't go there.
You've
Come
earned
on.
It, sir. You've earned it.
Okay, all right, professor. Thank
for
you.
For God's sake. And by the way, and to freeze your ass off, are you up in Cornell right now?
Yes, but it's balmy. It's beautiful.
I was just
you want to be here.
I know. I was just in Boston. It was 50 degrees. Although when I got
there,
that's
okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but usually it's a little too cold. But I will call you professor because you're.
Well, we don't want it to be too warm out here. So this morning I spent some time out in my backyard where my dog likes to walk around, and when he needs to, well, I don't know if I need to go into this.
Listen, man, you can do whatever you want.
Well, if it's too muddy out there, picking up his poop is worse. So I don't mind it being cold.
I like it. We're already talking about poo. I love it.
Yeah, well, this is what you get as a math professor. I mean, it might sound glamorous, but
well, that's the thing. I mean, I wanted to get people. We have a lot of young listeners, and we live in a very innumerate society where people really don't live in math and don't know how math works. And I'm sorry, I'm one of the people that's guilty of that. And it's very easy to go through your life being somebody who's ignorant of how math. I mean, I took up to calculus and things like that, but you do a really good job of explaining sort of how and why this applies to our life, and you make it so accessible. And so, I guess, and you break it up into different chapters. I mean, you relationships and the way you kind of describe what calculus really is, and that's kind of relationships and shapes and change, and then data and frontiers. Data dealing with those messy things, just how life changes at the speed of life, and all that stuff. And we use this stuff every single day of our life, and whenever it seems the crap hits the fan, we always turn to guys like you to help us explain it.
Okay, well, I don't know if I would recommend that, but okay.
Deal with that, Professor.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a funny thing. I mean, people do tend to have all kinds of different reactions to the school math that they had. I mean, for some people, it was a pleasure, but for most people, I guess I would say, it was either a traumatic thing, like they end up feeling stupid or humiliated. And then for others, it's just boring. You know, mm-hmm. they get it. They can do the work. They can do what their teacher tells them, but they don't really see the point of it. And when it's all over, you know, they've graduated and they think, I don't really know why I just did that for 16 years.
Exactly.
So it's, yeah, it's a tough thing. I mean, when you mention it's an enumerate society, I don't know. I mean, I agree with that, but I'm not sure where the problem is. Is it the students? I kind of think it's the curriculum. I don't want to blame the teachers because it's a hard job that they have. And
I think it's conceptual. I think see, when reading your book, if you were to teach math to most kids, I don't think you'd be, I mean, you have to get to a point where you have to explain why, you know, the way you describe algebra and stuff, there's a number in the middle and things, but the way you, it's really a question of how it is presented. And then more importantly, how it relates to people's lives. That's what is not done. I didn't learn that way.
No,
I was just told it's the queen of the sciences and learning to go through these formulas will teach you how to think. My father would always say, it'll give you ammunition against the...
Put hair on your chest.
Yeah, it'll give you ammunition against the communists. Yeah. I mean, literally.
Wow, you've touched on some really interesting things there. I mean, it's true that for a long time, it was a weapon against the communists. That is, we felt like we had to pump up our science and math in this country because... You know, the Russians were building hydrogen bombs faster than we were, mm-hmm. and we needed a group of people who could keep up. So there was that argument. And then, you know, like your dad's argument is one that you hear a lot from people who are really well-intentioned, but they don't know what the point of math is either. They just think it's sort of like your gym teacher who said you got to do jumping jacks, not because there's a sport of jumping jacks, but because it'll get you in shape for something that does matter. Mm-hmm. Same, you know, that's the argument your dad was making, that this will help you think, even though it's pointless in itself. Mm-hmm. You know, that's sort of what was the agenda behind
what he was saying.
And it's not really true. There's a lot of point to math, but most people don't know it because we're never telling them.
Well, that's what I want to touch on because, you know, as you're talking, it's so funny. I was in Boston and I like to do a little jiu-jitsu and boxing, and I went to this fight gym. And I, because of like, I'm a comic, I can get into these gyms sometimes and it's fun. I get to move around with the professional fighters. And I thought to myself, here I am in a ring hitting mitts and sparring with this guy who could kill me. And why am I doing it? You know, just in case I get myself into a situation. I always like knowing that in a bar I can throw my hands. Now, it's a ridiculous thing because I'm going to be 47 in a couple weeks here. And by the way, I better have a good lawyer if I punch somebody in the face, et cetera, yes. et cetera. So we do have a tendency as human beings to want to always be ready for, you know, the emergency. But can you give us a sense of why math is important? I know I'm putting you on the spot, but...
No, that's the question I love. That's my favorite.
Yeah, tell us why.
Because there's all kinds of ways of trying to argue this, and I don't want to belabor it. I mean, I could give you a few phony arguments that I don't really believe, but I could also just jump to the real argument.
Yeah, jump to the real argument. I love those political arguments. Like, I could be political or I could tell you the truth.
Well, because there are a bunch. You'll hear a lot of things. I'll just touch on them quickly. But these are ones it's not that I don't believe them, but I don't in my heart think they're the real reason or that they're going to convince a young person. Hmm. So, you know, a lot of today's most important or highest paying jobs, you'll lock yourself out if you can't do math. I mean, you're not going to work for a hedge fund. You're not going to be in high tech. You're not going to even be in the biomedical world or, you know, there's a lot of things that if you decide I'm not a math person, you've ruled out all kinds of good jobs. So that's one argument that your, like, say, your guidance counselor will give you. But, you know, or another is the one about it'll build up the muscle of your brain. That's your dad's argument. But here's the argument I would make. I mean, I could give you a bunch more, but I think the real answer is nobody ever asks, why do I need to watch Michael Jordan play basketball? Or why do I need to listen to music? You wouldn't pose the question like that. Of course, you don't need to listen to music. You could just ignore music your whole life, or you don't ever have to watch Roger Federer or Michael Jordan. But obviously, you're missing something if you don't see those beautiful athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm trying to say is, if I can show you, I or any other good math teacher can show you that this will enrich your life and make your life deeper and happier, why wouldn't you want to learn it? Of course you would want to.
Of course. It's
because we're torturing you. That's why you don't want to learn it. Mm. And I don't blame you.
Boy, that's a beautiful way of describing it. That really is.
I really do believe that's the reason. That's why, I mean, and you know, kids always ask that. This is the question every math teacher hears. When am I ever going to use this? The kid doesn't really mean when am I going to use it, because they don't really, they're not, I mean, yeah, if you're an engineer, you're going to use it, or if you're an architect. But what the kid really means is, when am I ever going to use it is code for saying, I don't know what you're talking about, and I don't want to learn it, and since I'm never going to have to use it, I don't need to learn it.
Mm.
But if you would just tell the kid, that's right, you don't ever need it, but look at this. Look at how either how fun this is or how satisfying to get the right answer.
Mm-hmm. Or it sounds to me like you're actually talking about a hidden beauty.
There is beauty. I mean, the beauty is one motivation, but I guess I don't want to stress that to the exclusion of everything else, because some people get pleasure out of the craftsmanship of it. Mm-hmm. Just getting the right answer, seeing the numbers adding up and working out is for a lot of people the pleasure. I mean, my kids, I have two daughters who are 11 and 13, and if I talk to them about the beauty, they're totally turned off by that. They're just happy that right. they're getting the right answer, and that's mm-hmm. satisfying to a kid.
Yeah,
so
yeah, working.
I sort of think
problem.
The beauty argument is more for grown-ups. Mm. I think for kids, and maybe for many grown-ups too, just the pleasure of dealing with a subject where there's right and wrong, you know, compare that to so many things in life where there is no absolute truth. There's just a lot of opinion. Here's the one place in human existence where you can get the goddamn thing right, and you know that you're right, and mm-hmm. nobody can ever contradict you.
Well, you know,
that's nice. The Greeks,
Socrates would pull out math when he wanted to prove a problem.
The Greeks were really good at that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Hunter said something that I thought was really cool, and I'll let him take this. He said, reading this book we were talking about, he said, I felt like it was a little bit like Alice in Wonderland. You know, you were showing us a world that we didn't know existed, and that's what's so cool. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I love the Lewis Carroll books are some of my favorite books of all time, and what he does so well is to show you that the things that seem so ordinary in your everyday life are actually remarkably weird. And you know, I mean, that is one of the themes that comes through in reading The Joy of X is just like, oh, I mean, like, I love the story that you tell about when you were, you know, helping your daughter with her math homework, right? And suddenly find that it's quite difficult because they have some new method of doing it, right? You're a
That's
Cornell
right.
math
yes.
professor.
Yeah, you're like this renowned mathematician
yeah, exactly.
who's written these, like, papers that people cite, and you don't know how to help your daughter.
That
so
happens
funny.
To me every night. That's still happening.
I
so
love
funny.
It.
But you know, I mean, and that, you know, most of us would just be frustrated, but, you know, you then take a look and say, well, actually, you know, multiplication is quite weird, and there are a lot of quite weird things about it. And I just think that mystery and that wonder is so great, and that's so much of what you don't get in most math classrooms.
You kind of blew my mind with 7 times 3 and then 3
oh, yeah.
times 7 are two different things. And I was like, what are you talking about, man? And then you started to explain it. Explain that to us a little bit.
Well, yeah, I'm glad that Hunter and you're mentioning that, Brian, because I mean, we're all taught in school this thing that they call the commutative law, which is a huge turnoff right away. It's a fancy word that you would never use in your life, commutative.
And I will. Say, I'll yeah, start using it now. Oh, yeah, use it. Makes me sound smart as shit.
I just commutative to work.
Yeah, go on.
You know, so, okay, but if you remember what it is, A times B is B times A. Now, what does that mean? So like you said, an example, 3 times 7 is 7 times 3. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, oh, you know, yeah, I know that already, but, well, it is kind of weird if you think about it. If 3 times 7 means let's add 3 to itself 7 times, then, you know, you'd start doing that. 3 plus 3 is 6, plus 3 is 9, and keep going, and then you get to 21. And if you compare that to doing 7 times 3, where you would go 7 plus 7 is 14, you know, the interesting thing about this is that as you're getting there to the answer, it's not clear that they're going to match up. I mean, it's not obvious, really, if you think about it. Why is it that 7 added to itself 3 times? In fact, let me tell you a little story. When I was in third grade, they tested me because they could see I was getting in trouble. I was playing games and I was distracting this kid named Rodney sitting next to me, and the teacher would send me out into the hall as punishment to just stand there. And I was so bored with my third grade class that they said, maybe you need to skip a grade and go into fourth grade. So they gave me a bunch of tests. They decided, yeah, actually, okay, you could go into fourth grade. I go into fourth grade the next day, and I think the teacher resented having a new student, and she gave a multiplication test the first day I got there. And I had never studied the multiplication tables. I didn't know what they were, but I knew what it meant. And she gave a question like, you know, say 2 times 9, and I didn't know what that was, but I knew that it meant you got to go 2 plus 2 plus 2 9 times. And I did not know that it was the same thing as 9 plus 9. I didn't know it was 9 times 2. And so I very clearly remember that I got a 36 out of 100 on that test.
Let's look
because
at that.
I did not know the commutative law. And she was firing those questions at us so fast. And if I had just known, you know, I might have been able to get a 60 or something.
Well, that's my question to you is, when did you realize you were good at math? Because you've really, I mean, I hate to use the word renowned, but I'm going to. You've written 3 books on math. And then the book we're talking about is The Joy of X, by the way, which might just be a play on the title of the book, The Joy of Sex.
But, yeah, yeah,
which,
yeah.
Which
yeah.
I thought was great.
Yeah. But we love big jokes in the math world.
You mathematicians, oh, you cowards. Yeah.
So wait a minute. Actually, I do have a one quick question. Have you read the play Proof?
Yes, I saw the play, too.
Okay.
I saw it with Jennifer Jason Leigh. And
so did I, yeah.
I'm trying to think, did I read it? Yeah, I don't know if I read it, but I know I saw it.
Well, one of the things they talk about is that at math conference, there's a lot of hardcore drugs and crazy, crazy sex.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is that true or not?
No, that's not true.
He's naked right now. He's in a leather swing as he talks to us, ladies and gentlemen. Professor Stephen Strogatz, he's brilliant and a pervert. Yeah. That's right. You want to get laid? Get into higher math.
Well, Einstein was.
Yeah.
Brilliant and a
Einstein
pervert.
Did have a very nice, he did have a good sex life from what we hear. I mean, he was, if you look at pictures of him as a young man, he was kind of a dashing young guy.
Look, but, he was a celebrity. Let me explain something to you guys.
Well, that's later. That's later.
If you're the smartest man in the world, you're getting laid. There are groupies out there. They may not, they got big brains. I don't know what their bodies look like, but anyway, I'm sorry. I'm going to get you in trouble because you're an academic.
You know, I'm still waiting for all that. Yeah, I don't know about this part, but I mean, it's possible that there are other mathematicians out there. It is true, actually, this part about drug or alcohol abuse. I would say I have known some mathematicians with alcohol problems. And I think, you know, that is really actually not funny. Mm-hmm. But as far as like having a lot of good times and sex, man, I don't think so. I'm not seeing that.
You're too busy. You're too busy working out theorems. And my, you know, when did you realize you were really good at math? Because you've obviously gone to the... You're as good as it gets in a lot of ways. I mean, it's kind of crazy to get to the level you've gotten. I mean, I'm looking at some of the things you've done. I mean, you've got some articles that some of the most highly cited articles about networks and things, and the 6th most highly cited paper in all of physics. I mean, you know, it's pretty cool that you've done some crazy stuff here. So when did you realize you were that good? Was it a natural proclivity? I mean,
So I was always pretty good at school, but math was not a special thing for me. I do remember in junior high school, meeting kids from another school that, you know, I was at North School. These kids were at a school in a different part of town. Then we come together in middle school. And I do remember one kid teaching me something about, I think there was some question about like 2 divided by 0. And I thought the answer was 0. And this guy was really laughing at me. You know, he said, that yeah, really? You thought that? Because that'd be impossible. That would mean 0 times 0 would have to be 2. Mm. And you know, you didn't know you can't divide by 0? Well, no, I didn't know. Nobody ever told me about that. I never really thought about it. And so I started out in middle school feeling a bit inferior to this guy. George was his name. And but I was very competitive, little prick. You know, and I thought, I don't know. If George could do this, I could do it. And so I remember with a lot of pride getting when the teacher, they would never do this nowadays. The teacher was reading out our averages, just every kid, you know, okay, Fred, your average is a 72. Billy, you got a 38. You know, George, you got a 97. Stephen, you got a 98. And I thought, whoa, I'm beating George. And so I started to think maybe I'm pretty good at math. I didn't really notice that.
Yeah. It was combat. And so it was combat.
So it was combat. Right, yeah. Exactly. At that age in my life, math was a competitive thing for the pecking order against other boys. Mm. And they're actually, you know, girls are very good at math at that age. That's before they've started to get socialized into the idea that they shouldn't be good at math.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's the case? I know it's very controversial, the idea that men and women have different minds, and they do. I have a daughter and a son. I'm sorry, but the female mind, the male mind, I'm generalizing, are different in beautiful ways. I really have always been in my own way a feminist in the sense that I just believe it's a meritocracy. I mean, if you can do the job, then I don't care what your genitals look like, you know, it doesn't, and what your chromosome pattern is. I mean, honestly, you know, but, I do believe that there are, differences in the male and female mind in some ways. It seems, I mean, I think there's a hard wiring there, and I don't care what anybody says. It seems that the science backs me up in some ways. What about that in the math question?
Well, it's a confusing bit of literature. You know, as you say, there's some evidence that boys and men are better at spatial reasoning than girls or women. But it's not clear that, first of all, the differences aren't that great. And I don't think that the differences you see translate to the really big differences in terms of representation. Like if you go to my math department faculty meetings, you know, we have 3 or 4 women professors and like 40 male professors, and you would say, is it really because the men are 10 times better than the women? Mm-hmm. That's not true. I mean, the difference, if it even exists at all, is not as great as what we see in the profession. And so there's something going on besides any innate differences. And I'm not really convinced about the innate differences, I have to say. I mean, the literature or the research I've read, or, you know, I mean, here's a common sense way to answer it. Try going to other countries where they don't have this same hang up. In Hungary, the women are plentiful in the math profession. It's just that there's something in America, especially, where we think it's not ladylike or girls don't need to do this. You're going to do something else. I think it's really discouraging for a lot of them. Yeah. So I don't really agree with you. I mean, yes, there may be some differences.
Because Hunter wouldn't agree with me either in this. I mean, yeah. Hunter, you wrote this book, The Straight-A Conspiracy. What does your research tell you?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, what you say about what we believe in this country about intelligence versus what other countries believe. I mean, the one that I think is the most glaring is what we believe about language learning. You know, here in the United States, if you tell someone you speak 2 languages, they're like, oh my God, you must have a natural ability. You can say, hello, how are you in 2 languages? You know what I mean? And you go to Holland, where my dad's from, and it's like, you speak 4 languages. So does everybody else. Nobody cares, right? And that's the thing. There are certain beliefs that predominate in different countries and, you know, in different cultural groups. Like Katie, who I co-wrote the book with, right? Her dad's from rural Maine, right? And the idea of speaking multiple languages is crazy. But by the same token, he can take apart any car in the world and put it back together, which to me is like mind blowing. Like, I don't know how you would do that.
Because you're an aristocrat.
Because I'm because I own many horses.
Because I have my staff do that for me. Touch a car? Really?
Dirt on my hands.
Let's go.
It's basically, I think that's the point, is that different cultures have different beliefs, and those beliefs become self-fulfilling prophecies.
Yeah. Professor, I want to jump on. We talk about drugs and sex and all that stuff, but there's this idea that some mathematicians go crazy because they're thinking so deeply. I love those movies where they just, it's too much for them.
The Invisible Beautiful Mind.
Is there any truth to that, sir?
Well, I would put it the other way around. I mean, there's a little question of cause and effect. I think it is true, actually, that math can be a haven for people with certain kinds of different minds. Mm. So, you know, like when you see A Beautiful Mind, the story of John Nash, the one where Russell Crowe was John Nash.
Right.
You know, John Nash did have schizophrenia, and he suffered from it for a long time. And by the way, he was actually much creepier than the movie showed. I was an undergraduate at Princeton when he was at the sort of the height of his sickness. Mm. And we used to see him milling around in his red high tops and his trench coat and his sad eyes. And he would no one knew who he was. I mean, he looked like a homeless person, and except that they would let him in the library, and he was always there looking at atlases or You know, but he would really stare at undergraduates in a way that was pretty disturbing.
Yeah.
And, but anyway, but back to the question, I mean, is there some correlation between mental illness and math? I mean, one thing I would say is that, you know, there's this Asperger's autism spectrum, which is like where you think of a really nerdy, geeky person, a math type.
Yeah.
And some of those people do have Asperger's or sort of high-functioning autism. Mm. And I think that math is a nice place for them to work, or computer science, where things are orderly and patterned and logical. Like, say, Sheldon on Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's clearly meant to be a guy with Asperger's syndrome. And we see a ton of guys that look like that.
Yeah.
And so that is true, that there is... Because, you know, on the other hand, you can't have that guy in the front office. That guy's not going to be a salesman.
Sure.
Like your Uncle Irv.
Yeah. But people with Asperger's syndrome do somehow, you know, I think the guy that figured out in the book called The Big Short by Michael Lewis about the financial crisis, the guy who was looking at these tranches and these derivatives and actually looking at how they didn't add up had Asperger's syndrome. He figured out that mathematically these things weren't making sense. So.
Yeah, I mean, you really want these people in society, and actually a lot of the tech people, maybe even tech people working in your studio there, you know, they are the kind of people who are good with getting things precisely right.
I'm looking at Rena. She's actually this good-looking woman. She just kind of hangs out with it. She's a voiceover artist. I love it. Hey, Rena, you got Asperger's?
Yeah. You little Aspie?
That's some hot Asperger's there.
Asperger's.
Rena runs the show around here. But that's a good answer, though. That's a very good answer.
Well, I want to flesh it out a little, because those are not the people you're interested in the movie. So, I mean, you want the more dramatic, crazy person who is either like a madman, a monomaniac that wants to take over the world, like the James Bond villains, or, you know, somebody who's really crazy in an interesting way. Like, and so we see them in Good Will Hunting. That poor guy is seeing the psychiatrist all the time. And in Proof, that guy decides to kill himself.
Yeah.
So... this part, well, there are cases of famous mathematicians who killed themselves or who went crazy, but I tend to think it was more like these are people who either were manic depressive or schizophrenic to begin with.
Right.
I don't think it makes you crazy.
No, Bobby Fischer was an example of somebody who just clearly was a little crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a genius and happened also to be, by the way, crazy.
He was very crazy.
Yeah.
Yes.
You do deal as a mathematician, and I want to talk, this is what fascinates me. You deal with, you know, math theory, number theory, things that can be imagined but don't have any bearing on the physical world we live in. And one of the things that I've heard and I find fascinating is you have a mathematician who lived 150 years ago. He sits there all day thinking up this crazy theorem that might be 150 pages long. It bears no relevance to the everyday world. And 150 years later, guess what? Somebody's trying to measure the inside of a conch shell or the spatial relationship between quarks. And, oh, this theorem actually does have relevance. In fact, it proves something. That, to me, is magical. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It is. You've really put your finger on one of the most, if not the most magical thing about math. I mean, it's the part of math that makes me want to be in the life that I'm in, which is this spooky, really eerie connection between math and these patterns in our mind and the patterns in the universe around us. That is, because that's how we would nowadays define math. We don't think of it so much as the study of numbers or shapes. Yes, it is that, but it's more than that. It's a study of all kinds of patterns. And so to the extent that the world around us or the world we create through our technology or our society has laws and patterns in it, then math is going to be the sort of secret language for understanding that. And so, I mean, here's a good example that we're all using all day long. Without even knowing it, anytime you get on the internet to buy something, you know, you're doing some online shopping, or maybe you're going to that porn site and you want to encrypt. You know, you don't want people really, like, you don't want someone knowing what you're looking at. So
I
you
beg
do
your pardon, sir.
Browsing.
My computer. Yeah. If you don't go to my history of my computer, my wife was like, "Oh, I'm married to a pervert." Anyway, keep going.
So,
with any luck.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
Hunter.
No. Go ahead.
Okay, but anyway, I mean, if you ask how does encryption work, and, you know, that is, how do you keep things secret on the internet, credit card numbers or whatever, all of that is done using a result from number theory, which is that it's very difficult, essentially impossible in practice, to take a gigantic number and factor it into its prime numbers. That is, that the difficulty of factoring is the basis for this thing called the RSA encryption algorithm, which is the military strength encryption that our government uses and that, you know, we use when we try to keep things secret from the NSA. And, of course, the NSA is very worried about it because they can't break it. No one can break it. And it's based on number theory that was, as you said, developed hundreds of years ago but now has found practical application in our daily lives. Mm. If you're thinking, you know, by the way, the NSA can read all our stuff, yes, that's true, but not by breaking the encryption. They have other back doors. It's not the math that's weak. It's that the manufacturers have let them in.
Wow. And so being able to encrypt something, you can encrypt something so nobody can actually break it.
It's unbreakable as far as we know mathematically, and there's no evidence. I mean, of course, who knows what the NSA has really done. Maybe they have found a way, but I don't think that they have, and there's good theoretical reasons to believe that that's not the weak link in encryption. It's other stuff. But no, I mean, that's a really nice practical example. In fact, some of the mathematicians who were really disgusted around the time of World War I, which many people think of as the most horrific war there ever was, the sausage grinder of, you know, trench warfare.
Yeah.
There were mathematicians who said, I never want to do anything practical again, calculating trajectories of artillery shells or anything like that. I'm going to go into the most pure, beautiful, safe part of math that will never be used for any evil purpose, number theory. Mm. And it turns out number theory, you know, fast forward 100 years, is used for encryption.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I, you know, I, there are beautiful things to think about. There was this mathematician saying, well, he would look at a hawk flying. And what he was thinking about was how much of the globe can that hawk cover or see as it mm-hmm. turns on its radius and, you know, and as the hawk flies in one direction. And those are the kinds of things that, you know,
well, that's my high school math teacher you're talking about. That was the way he used to think. I mean, that's his problem. He would ask us questions like, because he was a naturalist, a nature guy. I mean, he used to run the nature club at school, and he'd take kids out and teach them about birds or take them kayaking or, and, you know, so for him, also, he was a tremendous jock. This guy, my teacher that I wrote about in a different book called The Calculus of Friendship, Mr. Joffrey was his name, and he's still living. He's about 85 years old now. Uh-huh. Mr. Joffrey got 11 letters in college.
Wow.
If you can think about what that means. I mean,
wow.
You can only play three sports a year.
Yeah, what was he doing? Fencing as well? And I mean, you know.
No, man, the guy could do track and football. And I mean, he's doing manly sports.
Yeah.
And and wrestling, I think. And I think he was an Olympic caliber athlete, really. He later in life took up whitewater kayaking for fun, and he became the U.S. champion in whitewater kayak.
That's a stud. That's a stud.
Yeah.
With a bigger brain and bigger muscles. I hate him.
Well, the interesting thing, actually, is he was not all that good at math. He was good. I mean, he was my calculus teacher. But even as a high school student, I could see that he didn't know everything. And what was really very uplifting about him is that he would freely admit that he didn't know everything. You know, like some teachers act like they do. This guy said, no, of course I don't know everything. And I love it when my students can teach me things. And he kind of always gave us this metaphor that, like, math is like climbing a mountain. And this is really hard, and we're going to climb, and it's going to get tougher and tougher. And some of you will be able to go higher, and you can tell us what you saw up there. But all of us can enjoy climbing.
You can tell You can tell us what you saw out there. You know, that reminds me of the guy who won the Fields Medal in math. He was from Siberia, I think, or he was Russian, and he refused the prize, which was, I think, $1 million. And they found him in his aunt's shed working on another theorem in Siberia or something. And he said, well, why would I take the why are you giving me the prize? I'm just the frequency. I'm just the radio transmitter that channeled the theorem that always existed in the sky onto paper. Give the prize to the theorem, not the radio. I thought, what a mind. I was like, you nut. But it was such a beautiful way of looking at it, man. Like, not, it's not me. I just happen to have a certain wiring that was able to channel, find it in the sky. Fuck you.
That's what I want to say.
Where's that theorem? So awesome, though, you know? I was like...
That's some good rendition of... Yeah, Gregory Perlman is the guy's name. He solved this ancient problem that we call the Poincaré conjecture. And he's a good example of what you're talking about with the crazy guy. He decided there was no point cutting his fingernails. And his fingernails got so long that they started to curl and twist.
Really? What a freak! Yeah. I love this guy. Can you give us? I think the answer was 357 pages long or something. What? They didn't even know that the question existed, and then he proved that it did. Or something. Explain. Please shed some light on this.
This one would be hard to explain. I have to admit. I mean, I can.
I'm sure
it has to do with the nature of space. Like, picture instead of just ordinary space that we walk around in, or outer space. Think about the surface of a globe.
Yeah.
You know, that's a sphere.
Okay.
So we understand things about spheres. Like, you can certainly picture the globe. And here's a funny experiment that mathematicians like to think about. They want to think about properties of a shape by imagining rubber bands that sort of live on the shape and that are trying to shrink down to a point. That is, imagine like a really super elastic rubber band that's trying to shrink all the way down to nothingness. So on a shape like a tin can, if I put the rubber band sort of around the tin can, around the waist like a belt, then there's no way you can shrink the rubber band down to nothing because it'll be stuck on the can. Whereas if you put the rubber band on a sphere, I know I'm killing you with this.
No. What I like about it is how I'm zoning the frick out. I'm like, not in a bad way. Not in a bad way. This is what I mean. Where you're trying to describe, and I'm like, all right, let me follow this. But keep going.
I'm trying to get at the idea that shapes can be different in ways that aren't about how big they are, but about some property that, you know, as you could say in plain English, has to do with the nature of their holes.
Okay.
You might like this. That gets back to the sex thing.
I was going to say. Let me get my hand down my pants. Keep going.
Right. Get your hand down.
The joy of X.
Yeah. Think about this, actually. Think about your own body and its orifices. Don't get too disgusting about
I won't.
You know, you got nostrils. You got other holes that connect. That's sort of – actually, your body is a good example of a branch of math that we call topology, which is the study of surfaces and their holes. And, you know, mathematicians always like to talk about donuts or bagels. That's a shape which obviously sort of has a hole in the middle. They're always talking about the donut hole and or an inner tube. Anyway, I don't want to go on too much. But the thing was with the Poincaré the Poincaré conjecture was a hard problem about what happens if you have these shapes that are one dimension higher than one we're talking about. We were talking about surfaces. There are solid three-dimensional things that can have different natures of their holes. And so anyway, Gregory Perelman studied this and solved this problem from the great mathematician Poincaré from 100 years ago.
Amazing.
And I don't know if it was so much about that he was channeling it from the atmosphere. I think his objection was that other mathematicians were indispensable in setting this up, and he didn't think it was fair to single out one, that this is a whole collective enterprise. Yeah. Why would you give the prize to one person?
To the guy standing on the shoulders of giants, if I may.
Yes,
if
that's
I may.
It.
Yeah,
yes,
well, that's,
thank you.
That's I can imagine when you're working on these massive problems how humbling it must be. It goes back to what I was saying. The hard thing about being a human being is you can't know everything. And when you read a book like yours, like The Joy of X, you realize there's a world out there that most of us are ignorant to. And it's a beautiful, interesting, fascinating world that will enrich your life the more you know about it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and it's
really true. And also, I was thinking earlier, I mean, it was nice of you to say those things about me as being a great mathematician. But any of my math friends who tune into your show, and I know they all listen, you know, they're going to be...
We have a huge mathematician fan base. Every time I walk around...
I mean, they're going to be thinking that they know I'm not the best. And it's just like any other thing where, you know, when you talk about going to these jiu-jitsu places.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure you're pretty accomplished, but then you see guys who are really scary good.
Yeah.
And then those guys aren't even anything compared to the world champion.
Yep. Yep.
You know, it's like that in anything that human beings do. And so for me, yes, I'm a good mathematician, but there are guys who are so good at just, you know,
Oh,
well,
man, it's
but
scary.
Describe that. I mean, when you, so give me an example of the things that you, what, are you working on anything right now? Do you, what do you think about? What was it? What were the things that, that you, you know, we all know that the thing about life, if you're a comedian, if you're a mathematician, whatever it might be, original thought is always the sort of the quest, isn't it? I mean, sort of coming up with something original, something nobody else has thought about. That's that for me is always what nags at me. And I'm sure for a mathematician, it's ever present. For a writer, it's the same thing. How do you wrestle with that? I mean, is that something that you've had to deal with when you're dealing in higher math? It feels like that's always the case, isn't it? I mean, you're
well, that's right. You're trying to do something new and something that will excite you, that will be appreciated by the people that care about the same things you do, and you know you're always aware of your own limitations. You like, I mean, in my case, I think of guys who are just so much faster or know so much more. And the more you think about that, the less you're going to do. You're going to psych yourself out and you won't do anything. You'll just give up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's best to sort of, I think, in any art or anything, you know, in sports or whatever, you just have to think, I love this enterprise. I love what I'm doing and I'm going to think about my art and I'm not going to think about that I'm really not that good at it. Sort of like my teacher. Like Mr. Joffrey, he didn't care. He wanted to climb that fucking mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
There were better mountain climbers, but he's going to climb it for himself.
Yeah.
And so I try not to think about it because I know if I do, I'm not that good. But,
yeah, I remember reading Faulkner when I was in college and I was trying to write. And I read The Sound and the Fury. I think I read it twice back. Like I just turned around and read it again because I couldn't figure it out. And I was like, well, I'm not going to. What am I writing for? I mean, I'm starting with the guy at the top of the American cannon. Nah, I won't do this anymore. I think I'll stick to being a jackass. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it can be very daunting if you start comparing yourself to the giants.
Yes. So, but then the subject itself can give you a lot of pleasure. And so for me, you know, like one thing that has fascinated me in my own research, I probably spent 20 or 30 years thinking about it, is how do things get in sync? You know, like if you have an audience and people are clapping. In America, people just clap and they don't pay attention to the person next to them clapping. And it just sounds like a noisy, raucous, disorganized mess. And that's what they're trying to do. But sometimes, like if they want to get the performer back out on stage, here we don't really do it so much. But if you were like in a concert in Europe, especially Eastern Europe, the audience knows culturally, to start clapping in unison. And they make this thunderous, synchronized clapping. And nobody is the leader. I mean, there's nobody on stage saying everyone clap like this. People just listen to their neighbors. They figure out if they're behind the beat or ahead of the beat. And then they just adjust. And pretty soon, out of nowhere, the whole audience is in this thunderous, synchronized rhythm. So, you know, we see that all over the place in nature. It's happening right this second in your heart. You have 10,000 special cells, your pacemaker cells in your heart that are doing this. And they've been doing it ever since you were born, and they'll do it the whole rest of your life for 3 billion beats in your lifetime. And there's no cell that is the pacemaker for the pacemaker. They just democratically figure out all 10,000 of them, this is how we got to do it.
Did you
and of
give
course,
a speech?
They're not figuring,
did you give a talk?
I'm sorry,
about
they're
this?
Not figuring anything because they're cells. They're not thinking. They're just sending electrical signals to each other that automatically makes it happen.
Did you give a speech about this for TED, for the TED conference?
Yes, that was what my TED talk was
I watched
about.
I watched it, not knowing that was. I watched that a long time ago, and it turns out that with sparrows and with fish, they're actually taking the cue from the fish or the bird next to them. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Wow, good memory.
Yeah, I love that. I remember listening to you. I can't believe that. That's funny. And now you're on the podcast. I remember being fascinated.
Well, the funny
with
thing
that
about that
talk.
So when I gave that talk, that was about 2004, and TED was not putting their stuff on the web at that point. And I remember being, I had a lot of other stuff going on in my life at that point in my work, and I didn't have any time to prepare. And I thought, whatever, I'll just go wing it. I hadn't heard of TED, and I thought, I'm just going to wing it, and nobody's going to see it anyway, just whoever's there, you know, a few hundred people in the audience. Now it turns out they put it on the web. It's been viewed 250,000 times or something.
Wow.
And and I wish I had done a better job. I really...
You did. I thought you did a great job because I remember it as you're talking about. I remember it very well. And it was something that I'd always been fascinated by because you hear about it and you're like, yeah, how do they know to organize and to school that way. And if you and you well, you had this slideshow where you showed these birds, and they it looks like it's just the most beautiful thing. It's literally like these swirls of black. And it turns out that they are all taking cues from the animal next to them, you know. And somehow, though, it all works as one. Again, that's you might be able to explain that mathematically. It's still pretty magical to watch, man.
It is. It is magical, and it's. I mean, I found it very inspiring, and I mean, more than inspiring. It's sort of chilling to me when I see that because it makes me feel like this is a. The secret of the universe, not to get too mystical on you, but that where does the order come from? You know, you go to school, you hear this word entropy, and they talk about things get more disorderly. And you know that that's partially true, but it can't be completely true or can't be true under all circumstances because we see magnificent structures around us, our own bodies, the galaxies, the societies. You know, even in economics, like the libertarians, I mean, not that I am one, but they will tell you if you just leave everyone alone and let people be greedy and self-interested, it actually will self-organize in a way that will be good for everybody. Get the regulators off our backs.
In some ways, and they're right. I mean,
there's some truth to that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the economic.
There
I mean,
is some truth to yeah, that. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's.
The marketplace. The marketplace. If a real marketplace, if you let a marketplace, and you see this all the time. I mean, local marketplace. It does work itself out. I mean, if I went to remodel my house, the stone cutter, the painters, the craftsmen, the carpenters, they all know each other. Your reputation is what matters. They don't need regulation. You screw one person, and believe me, everybody's going to hear about it. It's a beautiful machine when you see how a real marketplace works. Yep. I'm not talking about the financial industry, which has been heavily regulated since the 1800s. I'm talking about, you know, a real marketplace. It does find its way. It does have amazing natural checks and balances to it.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I mean, so I do think that that's a deep principle in nature. And as you say, I mean, we can see it in our economic dealings, in our everyday markets. And it's basically how our bodies work. I mean, at every scale from our cells all the way to our societies, if they're allowed to do their own thing, they can show amazing order. And so I feel like this is a giant principle in all of science, not just in math, but, you know, in everything from social science to physics. And so I sort of have spent my mathematical life trying to understand how does this work, what are the limitations of it, what are conditions that help it work better, how does it work.
Yeah.
That's the area I've always thought was interesting, and that's so.
What about the number?
Sync is the buzzword I use for that. Things getting in sync.
And you wrote a book about that.
And there was a book called Sync about that. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'll be reading that because it's fascinating to me. What about the number phi that I read in the what was it, the Da Vinci Code, the number of nature where like the spires in a I don't even know if that's a word, but the spires in a conch shell are the same as the spires in a sunflower are correlate to the same number of like bees in a hive. And I don't know. Explain that to us, please.
Well, there is a nice passage in Da Vinci Code where Dan Brown has his character. I forget that guy's name, the Tom Hanks
Tom
character.
Hanks.
Yeah, Tom Hanks. For those of you who don't read.
You know what I mean.
For guys like Professor Steven Sorokatz, who doesn't read, whatever, dude. He waits
Come
until
on,
the movie comes out.
What's the guy's name? What's the name
I
of the
can't
professor?
Remember. I read the book
the
a symbologist. Long time ago.
Robert Langdon. There we go, Robert Langdon.
There we are. All right.
Okay. Sure. Tom Hanks.
Yeah. So, yeah, Tom Hanks.
A.K.A.
Hey, that was actually, I was not Googling that. I'm in a soundproof booth here I'm cut off. That was out of my head.
Okay. I like it. Okay. I like it, yeah.
But anyway, Robert Langdon gives this speech about the Fibonacci numbers, which you can get by, you start with 0 and 1, and then you just add. So 0 and 1 makes 1. 1 and 1 is 2. 1 and 2 is 3. 2 and 3 is 5. 3 and 5 is 8. You just keep going, and you take two numbers and add them to get the next number, and then you just keep doing that. So these numbers, like 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, and so on. You keep going. That's this famous thing, the Fibonacci sequence. And from a mathematician, Fibonacci, from the 1200s, who incidentally is the guy who brought Hindu-Arabic numerals from India and the Islamic world over to Europe. So the numbers we all have today come from Fibonacci I mean, he was the carrier from India.
God.
But anyway, the Fibonacci numbers we see everywhere in nature, and it's a kind of a hard to understand thing. I was just thinking about it this morning. It's funny you mention it, that I was eating an apple, and you may have noticed this. If you know, normally people cut their apple vertically along the stem. Mm-hmm. But if you ever try cutting the apple sort of sideways?
Yeah, it's weird.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
If you cut it that way, do you know what the seeds do? Have you ever noticed that?
I think they get to the when I cut it that way, I think they fall out, or they're
they will fall out, and yeah. There's five of them. Uh-huh. They're arranged in a really almost perfect pentagon.
Wow.
So you mentioned about five.
Yeah.
I mean, just take an apple and slice it sideways. You'll see this very pretty pentagon, five being one of the Fibonacci numbers.
That's weird because I don't like slicing an apple that way somehow.
Well, no one does.
But isn't that funny? There's an order to the chaos where I go, I don't like I want to cut it this way. Right?
Well, anyway. It's gross. You're cutting the seeds in half and it's messy. And anyway, nobody wants to eat the seeds generally. But anyway, the point being that numbers like 5 and 8 and 13 are not arbitrary, but you can find them in plants, as you mentioned, in the structure of pine cones. They're spiraling shapes of the little florets on the pine cone, and they're always a Fibonacci number of spirals. I mean, this is a question that the biologists and mathematicians are still trying to figure out. What causes these numbers to appear in nature?
Mm-hmm.
And we have ideas, but we're not sure.
But there is an order to nature then. I mean, you know, right? I mean,
totally.
Which actually leads me to think that we're put on this earth as human beings are. The idea someday we're going to figure out how all of this stuff works. That's what it feels like. You know, why? Because it's there. And because the question is there to be answered, right?
And when we do figure it out, it'll probably be through math.
Well, yeah.
Well, or Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Galaxy.
Says the answer
right.
is 40. Yeah, 42 is the answer, but I don't really know why.
Yeah, but it's true that kind of stuff fascinates me. The idea that it's almost like these tantalizing clues or these things like keep coming. You know, here's a little tidbit for you, and it's almost like this treasure trail, right? I mean,
yeah,
for a mathematician, I would imagine.
Well, that's right. It feels like that there's a kind of a secret world. And it's invisible. Unless you know math, you can't see it. You don't even know it's there. And if you do know math, the curtain is pulled back, and it's totally like your Alice in Wonderland analogy from earlier, that you're walking in this enchanted place, and you can see things that the rest of the world – or also it's like the sixth sense, right? I mean, the kid says, I see dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that's a spoiler for anyone.
But, shucks.
You know, I mean, so for us with these math goggles – we see these patterns. We see the numbers and shapes and weird patterns that no one else is seeing. And for me, they're all around, like the ghosts in the Sixth Sense. And they're really what's going on. You think you see what's going on. You're not seeing anything.
That's what's amazing to me.
Yeah.
That exactly. And by the way, it bears mentioning that that you may be working with theory, but a lot of times these math theorems actually play out in the physical world eventually. They are relevant to making our lives better, maybe in some cases worse when it comes to nuclear fusion and things like that. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is they are going to affect us. There is an objective reality to numbers eventually. Math theory may very well in 100 years or 50 years or tomorrow be the theorem some guy's working on, like this guy Perlman, actually bears physical relevance to our lives.
Well, let me throw in an example of that I think you'll like, which is, so in the 1800s, people were playing around with magnets. And you remember there was Ben Franklin with his electricity and the kite.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the laws of electricity and magnetism were a big mystery to people in the 1700s. And as they gradually started getting figured out, these laws of electricity and magnetism could be written using math in the form of something that people learn in high school called vectors. And then you can apply calculus to these vectors. And so vector calculus is the math that is perfectly suited to understanding electricity and magnetism and how they work. Now, the climax of the story is that in the late 1800s, a mathematician in Scotland named Maxwell starts playing around with the equations just for the fun of it. He's manipulating the equations, not really thinking about anything practical. And he discovers that electricity and magnetism, his equations tell him, can propagate as a wave. They could travel through empty space And when he calculates the speed of how fast they propagate, it turns out they travel at the speed of light. So he has discovered in that moment in his, you know, hovel up in Scotland, the secret of what is light. I mean, people knew about light since people opened their eyes, and it turns out light is an electromagnetic wave. Now, why does that matter? Because that's what we're using right this second. I mean, when we're communicating across the continent from here to I'm in the East Coast, you're in the West Coast.
Yeah.
We're using electromagnetic waves right now. And anyone who's using their cell phone or wireless in their house, it's all because of James Clerk Maxwell and vector calculus.
You know, whenever you talk about the great ideas and thinkers in history, Maxwell always comes up. He's one of the fathers of the Scottish Enlightenment, and I never knew why. But thank you for thank you. Now that I do know, I'll be dropping that name as well. But that's
we
a
had
classic
James
example.
Clerk Maxwell on the podcast last year.
Sort of. At least Professor Strogatz. That's quite the contribution, you know.
Yeah.
That's like when, if you're Scottish, at least you can claim that, you know, you've got Haggis and you've got Maxwell.
And you've got Wealth
Hume,
of Nations.
You've got Hume, you've got a lot of great thinkers.
Yeah,
but,
Adam Smith.
Adam Smith. But that's fascinating. Can you in layman's terms for us for a second explain, and maybe it's impossible, how in the world some guy by candlelight in Scotland, when the rain's falling, says, figures out that, first of all, can measure that light travels at 186,000 miles per second or whatever it is?
Well, that was known before him.
Okay.
So people had done measurements with very tricky systems of mirrors.
How do you do that?
You can do things where you have a machine that's got mirrors on it and it's spinning very fast. And if you're shooting light off it, off these spinning mirrors, it can then reflect into another mirror where it can be captured and recorded. And I mean, I'm not describing it enough in detail that this will make sense.
I'd have to go to college. I'd have to go study math for a while. Yeah.
The people had estimated the speed of light pretty accurately, even in Maxwell's time, using tricky optical experiments with rotating mirrors. So he knew the number. And so for him, it was this, I wish I could have been a bug on the wall in his room in Scotland, because he would have known that number. And I'm sure he wasn't expecting it. He just was trying to figure out how fast. First of all, he was surprised that these things could move as a wave. He didn't know what that wave meant. Then, like any mathematician, he wonders how fast is the wave moving. He calculates it and he recognizes the number. He must have pooped in his pants. What would he? That must
incredible.
Have been the most unbelievable thing.
Yeah, because you change history. I mean, as a human being, you sat in a room and all of a sudden you come up with something that's going to change the way we look at reality. That's what's incredible about. We're going to wrap this up. I don't want to take too much of your time, but I'm so glad to get somebody like you to explain how important this kind of stuff is. And you know, there's something heroic about sitting there and staring at a wall and coming up with these answers that then we all benefit from. So we never talk about our idea of a hero as somebody with a sword and a big chest.
Oh, yeah, thanks a lot, actually, because, I mean, I really would like it if some people would start to think of, well, guys like me as heroes, because the truth is a lot of us really are. The world wouldn't be the way it is without us. You know what I mean.
I think so. No,
absolutely.
Listen, you're here explaining it to us, and you spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff, and you've made a name for yourself in a very, very difficult field. And you're right. I mean, when we need answers, we look to guys like you. And usually it's in the area of prolonging our lives or coming up with technologies that make things more joyous. I mean, being able to see things underwater, for example, or attaching nanobots to birds so we can see what they, you know, get a bird's eye view of the world, et cetera, et cetera. So,
and allowing us each to fulfill our own dreams. I mean, that's what technology, that's what science allows us to do. It allows us to fulfill our greatest ambitions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the answer is out there, ladies and gentlemen.
And it will be written in math.
Professor, let me say something. You got a standing invite. It's an hour really isn't enough time, but we very much appreciate your time.
Well, thanks, Brian. I really enjoyed this. And I have to say, I was a little psyched out coming on the show. I told my wife this morning, like, I do these things occasionally, and I'm usually pretty comfortable. But I said, I don't know, I'm a little nervous about this today. I don't know what.
Because you're dealing with a
I thought you were going to eat me up.
Nah, you're dealing with a huge, sometimes working actor, bro. Come on, man. You're dealing with,
no,
you're dealing
great.
With a
I would
C-level
love to come
celebrity.
Back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We'd love
Thank
to have you,
you
back.
I'll come back anytime.
I mean, that's the thing. It was so great to talk about The Joy of X, which, by the way, is like such an awesome book. It
does Read
such
the
a
book.
It's so good.
Yeah.
But also to even talk about some of your other books. Like, you know, we'd love to talk about Sync. We'd love to talk about, you know, Chaos Theory. I mean, that's a whole can of worms. And we should also just thank again Cornell University for allowing us to have the use of the studio, which is why there's such an awesome sound connection.
Yeah, it's a great. I didn't get into the school. It was, my grades weren't good enough in high school. But thanks, Cornell. Thanks a lot. But it's a great school. It's a good thing. But so thank you. And you know what we're going to do is I want to read those two other books.
Yeah.
Sync. And
then
and what is it? What is
well,
the other
and also
one?
The chaos.
Calculus of.
Oh yeah, the
one
calculus,
called
of,
calculus
friendship.
Of friendship.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then I think you might actually get into the calculus of friendship because it's a story of two men who are, you know, one's in the prime of his career, one is a kid, and it's a friendship that goes on for 30 years through letters, which people don't really write letters anymore. But my math teacher and I wrote to each other a lot for those 30 years. And my wife said to me one time, that's really sweet. You must know everything about your teacher. And I said, you know, actually, I don't know anything about him because we just write about math problems. Hmm. And she said, oh, man, that's such a guy thing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like the two guys are very happy to play a game together or do the thing they love together. And they don't have to talk about each other's lives or their kids. That stuff doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's what we did for 30 years. And then, you know, but except stuff happens in 30 years to both of us. Some things good, some tragedies. And so it's this story of these two guys who true story who of guys who, you know, deepen their friendship by finally opening up, though it took a heck of a long time.
I look forward to reading it. I love The Joy of X, and I'm going to read the rest of your books, and we're going to have you back on. No need to feel psyched, because you're fantastic, and it's a lot of fun to talk to a guy like you, man. It's exciting.
All right. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Brian. Thanks,
Hunter. Professor Stephen Henry Strogatz. What is that name? Is that, what are you? Are you Dutch or something? Who knows?
Yeah, it's something Jewish from Eastern Europe. You know, we were busy.
Thank God
got
for the Jews.
A lot.
Exactly. Yeah, they get
the
really
Jews
good at math. God bless, my friend. I appreciate it. You're a good man.
Thanks, Brian.
You do good
All
work.
Right, take
we'll
care.
Thanks
later.
So much, Professor.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
Really great.
Well, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. We talked about math, and poor Hunter's a little sick, so he was quiet. I like your haircut, though. It looks
Thanks,
fantastic.
Dude.
Very
it's
handsome.
Roman.
All right, guys. Check my schedule, briancallen.com. I'm going to be everywhere from Austin to Minnesota to Edmonton, Alberta. I'm doing stand-up all over the place. And then finally, Toronto. I'm excited. And thanks to all those people in Boston. That was a sick show, or sick bunch of shows. Peace!
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.